Let me just start by saying it's a real privilege, of course, to be preaching here at this conference. I'm the deacon here. I've been here for about a year. Prior to that, I worked as a locksmith, and part of that job, I actually worked here at the conference or the convention center in Phoenix, and I saw a lot of conferences. People get together and they meet for all kinds of things. They get together, they meet about how to make money and sell real estate and health products and everything. I saw a lot of that. But there's no conference like a missions conference. It's a real privilege to be here with people that are on fire for the Lord, that want to go out and reach the lost. So I count it a real privilege to get up and to speak in front of a crowd like this. And, you know, of course, it's assumed that I was asked to preach on this topic, the Native American reservations, because of the fact that I've been heading up the reservation soul winning here for the last year. But I thought maybe it might have been because Pastor might have caught wind of the fact that I myself am Native American. I don't know why everybody laughs. You know, they see my translucent children back there, and they think, you know, how could this be? You know, but you know, on my dad's side, he's 50% Oglala Sioux. I'm registered on the Rosebud up in South Dakota. I have cousins that lived on the res. I spent time there, so. And I've even got a Native American name. Now, I've debated whether or not I should share this, because this will probably be the only thing you get out of the sermon. If I tell you how I got my Native American name, you'll go, this will be the only thing you remember. But I'll go ahead and do it just for levity's sake, because to be quite honest, it's kind of a heavy topic when we start to talk about the history of Native Americans. When I was about 6 years old, living in South Dakota, my Uncle Chuck would set up a teepee in the backyard, and my mom would drop us off there to be babysat during the summer. Long story short, the teepee's being set up, and this is an authentic Native American teepee with 4-inch round pine poles that are about 15 feet tall and buffalo hide and all of that. And all day they're telling us, stay away from the teepee, it could fall down, stay away while we're setting it up. Well, you know how it goes, the day goes on, the rules get a little lax, we get a little too close to the teepee, and next thing you know, poles are going everywhere. And one comes straight down and falls on my head, bounces off, and I'm laid out in the dirt. So if you've ever wondered what's wrong with me, you know, that's a good clue right there. They rushed me off to the Sioux San Hospital. They took x-rays and they said there were no permanent effects. But, we come back after that, we leave there. And my dad says, well, let's go see if they got the teepee done over at Uncle Chuck's. We walk in there. All my cousins are sitting in the teepee. It's been completed. They're drinking root beer. And my Uncle Chuck, who's Native American, stands up and says, from this day forward, you are Falling Teepee. So that's my Native American name, and you know, it was a bona fide name from a bona fide Indian. So, and if you come on the reservation trip with me, because I've been you know, given the name, I can also give out names. I've given out a few out there. I was trying to recall a couple of them. I think we got one of them. Somebody got named Leadfoot. I don't know who it was, and then we had Train Man and others. But anyway, enough of that. But there in Matthew chapter 11, let's look at verse 2 where it says. Now when John had heard in the prison the works of Christ, he sent two of his disciples and said unto him, art thou he that should come, or do we look for another? Jesus answered and said unto them, go and show John those things which ye do see and hear and see. The blind receive the sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, and the dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. And this is such a great litany of miracles that Jesus Christ gives here. And I always, every time I read it or hear it preached, it always stands out to me the fact that after all these great, wonderful, and powerful miracles, the blind receiving their sight, the lame walking, the dead being raised to life, he ends it with the poor having the gospel preached to him. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I think he puts that in there because in many ways, you know, we understand a miracle is the suspension of natural law, but it really, it kind of in a way is a miracle because often the poor are the most neglected among us. There are people that are downtrodden and forgotten. And really it's a miracle if somebody takes the time of day or has a burden to go to those people and preach them the gospel. And really that's who the Native Americans are today. They are very poor people. And we'll talk more about that, but the hope of this sermon is just to inspire others to do what Faithful Word has done over the last few years. And that they would go out and reach some of the poorest among us in this country. The Pine Ridge Reservation up in South Dakota was for the longest time the poorest county in the United States, and it still ranks, I believe, in the top five. And many of the Native American reservations, you don't have to be there long to see that you're dealing with a very poor people. So that's the hope of this sermon, is to inspire people to go out and perform this miracle. That, you know, we might not be able to raise the dead, literally. We might not be able to heal the blind, but we can do this one. We can go out and we can preach the gospel to the poor, whether it be the Native Americans or any group of people that are poor amongst us. And Faithful Word has been very faithful at that. They've been knocking doors on many reservations. We've knocked, completed or nearly completed almost every reservation except for the Navajo Reservation, which is the largest. But we've knocked doors and finished the Fort Apache, the San Carlos, the Hulapai, the Havasupai, the Fort McDowell Reservation, the Gila River Indian Reservation. You guys will be helping us finish that up today. We have just a few pockets to do, just south here of Phoenix. The Tohono O'odham, which is the second largest in the state of Arizona. We've knocked every door there. We've knocked the densely populated regions of the Hopi and the Navajo Reservation as well. And there's still quite a bit to do out there on the Navajo and Hopi. So that's what we're working on right now. And we could talk about every single one of these tribes. And really, if we start to talk about Native Americans in general, there's so many stories, there's so many things we could talk about, so many different people with so many different beliefs and cultures that we could begin to discuss. But for the brevity's sake, we're just going to focus in on the one tribe today, which is the Navajo. Now, the Navajo, that is not a name that they gave themselves. The Navajo call themselves the Dene, which means people, or the people. And the Navajo name was something that was given to them later on by Spaniards and others. Now, they gave them that name, obviously, because they recognized the cultural and historical connection between the Apache and the Navajo. And see, both the Navajo and the Apache, they descended from the same Athabascan origins. Now, the Athabascan people were a people that came from Alaska and Northwest Canada. You say, well, how did they get here? Well, you know, it's the same reason a Michigander ends up in Phoenix. You know, you get tired of that weather, you pack up, and you get out of there, right? You get out of that snow. But they, the way they discovered that, the way they made that connection was actually through their language. When linguists began to record and classify Native American language, that's when they made this connection that the Navajo and the Apache were actually of Athabascan origin. And the languages of these two people in the Athabascan cultures and the Navajo and the Apache, they share a very strong grammatical structure in their language. They share a core vocabulary and many even archaic words. You know, an example of this that I read was the fact that for many generations, no Apaches or Navajo had seen a boat. They had, I mean, it's Arizona, but you're lucky to even find water here, right? So they had never seen a boat, but they used a word that to describe the gliding flight of an owl. And that same word was used by the Athabascan people to describe the movement of a canoe over water. And if you've ever seen a canoe move very quickly over water, it's the same kind of gliding motion. So they had the same word to describe this motion, though they're people that are separated by many thousands of miles. Another example would be the fact that the Athabascans used words for utensils that were made from horn, and these were the same words that the Apache and Navajos used for utensils made from gourds. So they had these same words, and that's how these linguists first established the connection of where the Navajo came from, where did the Apache come from. And when they first came here, they came here as one people. The Navajo are actually a breakoff from the Apache. And what's great, what I've admired about the Navajo and reading about them is how adaptable of people they are. That's one of the things. They adopt a lot of different cultures. They adopted the Pueblo people came into their tribe. That's how they've grown. They had just assimilated another tribe, a lot of other tribes, into their culture. And they didn't do away with the practices and cultures of those other people. They actually adopted them, made them their own. And a lot of great things have come out of that. And that's probably what's allowed them to flourish and grow into the largest Native American population in the United States. So they migrated as one people, the Navajo and the Apaches, from what is now Alaska and Northwest Canada. And they took a route that came down through the Great Plains and eventually east of the Rockies and settled down here in the Southwest. Now this wasn't something that was done all at once. This was a very sporadic migration that took time. It was something they took time over many, many years. And really that's where you start to see probably where you likely derive their creation story is actually from this migration that they took. And when they arrived in the Southwest, the local people, the local indigenous tribes here, the Zuni and the Tiwa people, they called these newcomers, they called them Apache, which really means stranger, or in some instances even enemy. So that's where that name first was given to them. The people who call themselves Diné were given that name by these first people, and that name was Apache. And those, once they got here, those that began to learn and adapt a life of agriculture, they settled into farming, and those people were later called by Spaniards the Apaches de las Navajo. I'm not a Spanish speaker, so I apologize if I just butchered that, but what that means is the Apaches of the cultivated fields, and that was later shortened to Navajo. So that's where the name Navajo even comes from. It was first from the local indigenous people that were originally here when they migrated, and then it was abbreviated by the Spaniards later. So they migrated here again from Northwest Canada and Alaska. And again, that migration, very slow, very methodical, didn't happen all at once. That's likely where their creation story comes from. And I just want to take a minute and kind of go over their creation story, because you'll notice there are some parallels even with the Christian creation story. And it's just interesting that every people, whether they're Christians or not, if they have some kind of creation story, there's often similarities between their creation story and the truth, the Christian creation story. So, of course, it starts out with first man and first woman. That should sound familiar to everybody in the room, first man and first woman. And they were formed in what they called the black world. And I've tried to kind of, this is all just, a conjecture on my part. I'm trying to kind of piece this together, considering where they came from and how they moved along, how this might have, this story might have developed over time with their migration. But they started out in the black world, and they were quarreling with insects, which forced them to climb to the blue world. Now, that instantly makes me think of, Alaska and that area where they have, long days and long nights. And if I understand correctly, maybe an Alaskan can clarify me, but don't they have a lot of black flies up there? Isn't that a big thing? So you can kind of see that maybe in their story. They're up there quarreling with these insects in the black world, right? And that made me think of that. And then they moved along to the blue world. And that's where they find the hawks and the blue jays and the herons and other insect beings. And then they move along to the yellow world. This is another world that they're moving through. And here, this is another parallel you can see with the fall of man, through another entity, another evil entity we would call Satan, and taking the form of the serpent. Well, in their story, they have in the yellow world a mischievous coyote, is what they call him. And he causes problems for everybody. And this leads to a great flood. So isn't that interesting how one thing just follows another, and there's all these great parallels between their story and the Bible. And this great flood leads them to what they call the glittering world, which is the land that they now inhabit, the land down here in the Southwest. They call that the glittering world. And this glittering world, this is the site of the six mountains, these six sacred mountains that are sacred to the Navajo and the Apache people. And four of these mountains, they form what has long been the boundaries for the Diné people. Now, those mountains, and I thought about trying to get up here and pronounce these in their in Navajo, but it's very difficult for me to do. So I'm just going to give you the modern names of these mountains. So the four boundaries that made up their traditional homeland was the one to the east was Blanca Peak in Colorado. You might have heard of that. And then to the south was Mount Taylor in New Mexico. And then to the west, most Arizonans should be familiar with this, of course, was the San Francisco Peaks, Mount Humphreys, which is just north of Flagstaff. That's one of the borders of this land. Excuse me. And then to the north was the Hesperus Peak in Colorado. So those four mountains, they formed the boundaries of the Native America of the Navajo people at that time. And then within that, they also had two central mountains that are very important to them as well. And they would and the Diné, this was a very important boundary to them. They would not cross these boundaries for fear of becoming ill, of being encountering bad spirits. And it was a very big deal then to not go beyond these boundaries. Now, again, the creation story goes on here. When they come and they arrive here in what they call the glittering world, the Navajo, their world continues to be shaped. That's when they construct the first hogan, which is the structure that you see displayed back there in the corner. That's a traditional dwelling that they live in. That's when the first hogan was constructed, the first sweat bath was taken. And of course, this is when they say the four seasons were established. Day and night are created, the stars are placed, the sun and moon came into existence. And it's during this time that another figure in their tradition called the Changing Woman, she is born on the center sacred mountain, which is Globernator Knob in New Mexico. And this is a very big part of their culture. If you go to the Navajo Museum in Window Rock, you'll see a lot of depictions of this in sculpture and painting. The Changing Woman gives birth to twin sons, and they are named Born for Water and Monster Slayer or Enemy Slayer. And these two sons of the Changing Woman, they go out and they defeat these mythical monsters that were said to plague the land back then. And one of those monsters was called One Walking Giant. And this was this giant that supposedly lived back then. Now, again, this is all fiction, okay? All right? This isn't Nephilim or anything like that. Don't go off on that. We're not teaching that here. They're saying, hey, there's this one walking giant. And these two sons, Monster Slayer in particular, he's the one that kills him. And I thought that was interesting because when you're up there, you'll notice if you go up into the Navajo Reservation, if you come in on the west side near Loop, on Loop Road, and you go anywhere out there, you're going to notice a great deal of lava rock. There's a huge lava flow that goes through that region. There's a dormant volcano up there. And according to the Navajo tradition, or what they teach, that was the blood of this giant that was slain back then. It's not lava to them. To them, they would say, well, that's the blood of this giant that was killed by Monster Slayer. And then if you go to the south, you get into the National Petrified Forest, and they'll say, well, that is the bones of this giant. So, you thought you were looking at petrified wood and lava. It was actually the blood and bones of this giant creature. So that's some of their beliefs. And of course, that's all made up. That's all something that's just taught. That's just tradition. We understand that. And, the Navajo, like many indigenous people, man is religious and spiritual by nature and is always going to attempt to explain things. They develop many strange and superstitious beliefs. If we don't have the Bible to guide us and man is left to his own reasoning, he'll come up with some strange beliefs. And the Navajo, they actually developed a very deep-seated fear of death and mortality. They didn't want anything to do with corpses. And that really led to them to actually not being the greatest of warriors. They were great raiders, but they were not a very organized people when it came to fighting war. And out of this deep-seated fear, they developed some strange beliefs. If you were Navajo and you passed away in a hogan, or you had a relative who died in the hogan, where the structure that they lived in, you couldn't just go in there and pick the body up and carry it out. You had to bust down the north wall. You had to punch a hole in the north wall of the hogan and take the body out that way. I'm not exactly sure why, but that's what I read. And then after that, they would not clean. No one was allowed to dwell in it. In fact, they would destroy that hogan immediately after that to cleanse that. They didn't have any kind of a concept of per se the devil, but they definitely believed in evil spirits. They believed in the malicious, ghosts of the dead. They would think that the people that died would often become very evil and vindictive spirits in the afterlife that could even invade your dreams. And that's where a lot of other tribes developed. Even you've probably all seen the dream catcher, right? That they would develop these things to try to protect themselves from these evil spirits invading their dreams. And another one a lot of folks might have heard about is skinwalkers. Who here has ever heard about the skinwalkers? Yeah, see? It's not just a Navajo thing, yeah. So the skinwalkers were a special classification of witches. And I'm trying not to scare the kids here too much, but I thought it was cool, so I'm going to share the story. But these were people that they believed and they said wore wolf pelts. And then they would go and rob graves. These were a special classification of witches that they had back then, they said. They would walk at night on all fours, had red eyes, and chanted holy prayers backwards to invoke evil spirits. Now that's creepy stuff. I mean, you thought Led Zeppelin was the first one to think of, play the record backwards and get demonic powers. They were way ahead of their time there, right? These people, they were said to go and rob graves of the dead. They would steal the burial trinkets, anything that they were buried with. And then they even alleged that they would take, you know, fingernails, hair, even flesh off of these rotting corpses. They would grind them up, and then they would make poisonous potions out of them to afflict people with. But really, so you can kind of get a sense of how afraid the Navajo people were of death and evil spirits and that kind of thing. And really, as I said earlier, that's what kind of kept them from becoming a formidable enemy to the armies that later came and conquered them. They were great raiders, but again, they were very unorganized. They had many clan systems. There was no real central leadership in the Navajo tribe. And, you know, that's probably why they were conquered a little bit easier than the Native Americans of the Great Plains. But before they would go on these raids, again, they were great raiders. They could go in and they could take whole herds of sheep. They had their paths and their highways that they could quickly get away with. They could take hundreds and even thousands of sheep and goat and horses from the Mexicans and the Spaniards and anybody else who was around them, other tribes. They were very, very effective at doing that. But again, even when it came to these raids, they had a lot of superstitious beliefs. They had a lot of things that they believed that were kind of unfounded. For instance, if you were a warrior and you were married and you went out on one of these raids, your wife was not allowed to leave the hogan, right? So maybe they were onto something there. You know, they had said the wife is to be a keeper at home, right, until the man returns, right? But she was not allowed to leave the hogan because of until the man came back in return, because out of fear of bad luck. They believed that was a bad. There was some bad juju on that or something. So another thing is, if they were on the raid, if they were on this, you know, I guess you wouldn't call it a war path, but if they're going out on a raid, and if a coyote crossed their path, if they stepped on a bear track, if they saw a snake shedding its skin, if they ate during an eclipse, right? If they wore a blanket with the stripes oriented horizontally, their raid was doomed. You know, if two bears came out of the hogan and he had the blanket on wrong, they said, well, you just ruined the whole raid, buddy. You know, and they would turn around and they would go back if any one of these things happened. So they were very superstitious people. And again, that's all because they're left without the truth. They don't know the truth. And their primary targets of their raids were generally livestock. And, you know, we definitely live in our modern culture. We definitely tried, I think, over-romanticize the Native American people. Again, we'll get into it in a minute here. Obviously, what took place during the conquest of the American frontier, there was a lot of innocent blood shed on both sides, and a lot of tragedy took place, unfortunately, on the part of the Native American people. But that's not to say that they were just these, you know, all in all, just these, you know, wholesome people prior to that. They were, they would go on these raids, and, you know, livestock wasn't always the only thing they took. A lot of times they would take women, they would take children, and others would do in turn the same in turn to them as well. But they would namely go after the livestock, and the Navajo were a very pastoral people. They moved flocks of goats, they moved flocks of sheep, and they would use their wool, and they considered the sheep and the goats a very sacred animal to them. They would tell their children, you know, the sheep is your mother, the sheep is your life. And they used their wool, they would eat their meat, they would drink their milk, and they would make these great blankets and robes, which today are still made in the same manner with the looms. And if you ever get out there and you get a chance to watch one of these be made, or even get to actually lay hands on one, you could go to Ganado, which is on the near the New Mexico border on the Navajo Reservation, and go to the Hubble Trading Post, which is one of the oldest trading posts in the United States that is still preserved. They have a lot of the same farm equipment was there. It was originally a homestead. But they sell their authentic Native American rugs. And I just learned this last night that there's rugs and then there's blankets. Blankets you can get a little cheaper. They're still great. They're very well made. And they're actually made to be used and worn, whereas the rugs are more decorative. And, you know, we took a trip up there, and I thought, well, I'm going to pick up one of these rugs. You know, it'd be a nice thing to hang in the office. And I go there, and then I realized a rug about this big is close to about $200 to $300. And then if you wanted to get one, you know, a little bit bigger, you could spend up to $2,000 on these rugs. But that just goes to show you the quality that goes into it. When you really start to look at them and you see the craftsmanship that goes into it, especially if it's made in the traditional way where they're pulling dyes and things to color it out of different plants and rocks and things from the surroundings. And these rugs are very impressive. Even back then, One Navajo blanket could be worth 10 buffalo hides on the Santa Fe Trail. So these were things that were very coveted. They even said by some that some of them were so well made and were so tight that you could actually carry water in them. You could go down to the river and take a rug and gather it and take it back to the camp. And that, again, was all from their sheep. And the Navajo, they revered their sheep. They spoke directly to the animals. They held them in very high regard. They would feed them pollen from plants. And they would even sing songs to them. You know, on these cold nights, it was said that they would sing songs to these sheep to try to keep them from freezing. And they slept on sheepskins. They made bags from their hides. They ate every single part of them. Every organ, everything got eaten. Even the blood, they would take the blood, they would boil that, they would mix it with, I believe it was like a corn mash, and they would make some kind of pink gruel out of it, and they would eat that. So they wasted nothing from these animals. And of course, this is all just kind of leading up to, where are they today? Where are the Navajo today? What kind of people are they today? We've looked at their creation story, but really who they are today is a direct result of who they were in the 1800s and leading up to that, even going back to the 1600s, when the Navajo were first coming into contact with Spanish settlers. The Spaniards began to come into the region in the 1600s, and they were greatly feared. The Navajo were feared by the Spanish, especially the settlers, because they considered them to be very powerful. And they were very very great, again, at raiding. They would come to them. They would raid their cattle. They would carry off women, children. I mean, they were a very fearsome group of people to them back then. And in fact, in 1610, the first Spanish capital of New Mexico was San Gabriel. They actually ended up closing that down and moving it because of all the raiding that was taking place. They were constantly being attacked by the local tribes there in the area, the Utes, the Comanches. But most of all, it was the Navajo. That's who they tried to distance themselves from the most, because they were considered the most creative and powerful raiders of all of them. And then, of course, they would try to evangelize them. Of course, these are, we're talking about Catholic missionaries. They were not bringing the true gospel. So there was nothing there to really reject to begin with. But still, no doubt, they're hearing about Jesus. They're hearing about a birth of a Savior. They're hearing about his death. They're hearing about sin and all of that. You know, which I believe is making them to some degree accountable to God for the truth that they're being given at that time. And in 1659, the account of Spanish Catholic missionary Fray Juan Ramirez, and he called the Navajo heathens who killed Christians and carried off others alive to perish in cruel martyrdom. So again, let's not over-romanticize the Native Americans too much. They were a very at times could be just as cruel as anybody else, and were very protective of their land, and even were very vindictive in many cases. And that was in 1659. A half century later, drawing near the 1700s, Governor Juan Valdez condemned the Navajo for their crimes, their audacity, and their reckless depredations upon this kingdom. They came to loathe the Navajo, and that was a sentiment that was carried right in when the Americans began to conquer. They had that same kind of mentality towards them. And you say, well, that's not a very nice thing to say to them. But you really, when you start to understand what some of the things they did to the Navajo, you can kind of understand maybe why the Navajo didn't really appreciate them trying to come and evangelize them, because there's even accounts of Spanish missionaries taking Navajos and literally chaining them to church pews and trying to convert them. So, talk about a captive audience, right? That's not exactly, we do not recommend that that should be a clue to your religion. If you have to chain someone to the pew to get them to hear and convert, you probably got the wrong truth. You probably got the wrong gospel. So you can kind of see why the Navajo, they didn't appreciate that very much. And that's probably why later in 1672, a group of Navajos hauled out one such priest right out of his church, stripped him bare, and then caved in his skull with a church bell. So there was a lot of conflict going back, all the way back to the time of the Spaniards coming in the region. Eventually, the Spaniards, they give up on trying to proselytize the Navajo or any of the natives back then. In about 1750, they just completely give up on it. And one priest said it was because they could not become Christians or stay in one place because they had been raised like deer. He's saying, look, they're just a bunch of wild savages. They're beyond hope. And the best thing to do is just slaughter them. And unfortunately, as I mentioned a minute ago, that is a sentiment that carried in even into our own, more modern American, culture during the 1800s. I can't remember the guy's name. Maybe this could be some trivia real quick. But the man who wrote The Wizard of Oz said that, and I'm paraphrasing, that there was nothing better for the Native American than to be put out of existence. That's who wrote The Wizard of Oz, by the way. He was a newspaperman before that, living in South Dakota. So you can see this sentiment goes all the way back, where they just write off the Native American and say, to hell with them, because they're just a bunch of savages that can't even become Christians. Of course, again, that's according to a man who doesn't even have the right gospel. So the Spanish, they begin to lead military campaigns against the Navajo. They capture livestock. They capture women, children to trade with the Mexicans into slavery. But they quickly understand something, is that conquering the Navajo is not going to be an easy task because of the lay of the land. And when you go out there, you find out when you're looking at it from a highway, from a main road, you look out over the land on the Navajo reservation, it's very flat. And it just looks like it goes on, and it does. But what you don't see are the many, 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 many canyons that run through that land. And the Navajo were very good. They knew that land by the back of their hand. And they could easily escape. They would hide out for from the Spaniards. They'd hide out from many of the American cavalry that came in there. Just could not find these people. They would have to sit there and wait for them to finally surrender. And they employed a lot of different tactics, the American military did, in order to bring them in. They would burn their livestock or burn their crops, kill their livestock. They would try to starve them out, basically. And that's usually at work because they could not catch them. They could not go into these canyons and find them. So they quickly understood, look, we cannot conquer these people. And in the mid-1800s, this is when we get in more to what we're probably more familiar with if we've studied, early American history, that time when America had gotten its independence and is now... it has its eyes on California, and really the only reason that they even went into the Mexican War is because it wasn't for this land. They just thought, hey, this has got to be a contiguous landmass because of the fact that we want California in order to do business with the Orient. So they of course go to war with the Mexicans, and then later they're trying to bring in the settlers across this land, and that's where they start the Indian Wars in the 1800s there, in the mid-1800s. And that's, of course, when they start rounding them up. They find out real quick that these people aren't just going to just, give up their land and walk away from it. Something that they've lived on for thousands of years, it's been their ancestors. Where else are they supposed to go? So they start to round them up, and then they begin the Navajo are beginning, like many tribes, are being forced from their lands by the U.S. government. And like so many of the Native Americans, they have their own tale of, which is just heartbreaking, really. I've read a few books on this subject, and I mean, there's a lot of tragedy that took place during this period. And for the Navajo, we would point to the Long Walk. You could point to the Cherokee and those that were brought over across the Mississippi and put into modern-day Oklahoma. They went, of course, through the Trail of Tears, where 4,000 people died in a forced march. We could talk about really the end of this era, where the last Native Americans were slaughtered at Wounded Knee. And, of course, right in the middle of that, approximately, you have the Long Walk of the Navajo. And what the Long Walk is when the U.S. government... forced marched the Navajo to an imprisonment, what would later be called a reservation, in the Bosque Redondo, which was in southeast Arizona. So in the beginning, this began in the spring of 1864. Bands of Navajo were led by the army. They were relocated from their traditional lands in eastern Arizona territory and western New Mexico territory to Fort Sumner in an area called the Bosque Redondo in the Pecos River Valley. Now, this march was this long walk is called that aptly so because it was a 400-mile forced march. Now, even just as an able-bodied, man or woman who's in tip-top shape to just be suddenly forced to walk 400 miles, that's no easy task for anybody, let alone a people that have been on the run. At this point, they've been on the run, they've been starving, and the first of these marches took place in the dead of winter. And they're being forced in December in freezing temperatures. They're forcing an exhausted, malnourished, improperly clothed people the elderly, the young, the pregnant. There were even women that gave birth along the way and lost their own lives as well as the child. And this took this march took 200 lives in an 18-day trek. People just died. And they received no aid. They received no sympathy. They received no remorse on the part of the soldiers who pushed them through these blizzards. And they left the dead unburied. They just left them there to rot. Now, you have to imagine just the thought of being forced into such a thing, you know, in itself was probably frightening enough. But they had no idea where they were going or why they were going there or even what would happen when they got there. And this wasn't just a one-time thing. It wasn't just, you know, hey, they were forced to do this once. This is something that happened repeatedly. In fact, there's 53 counted marches like this. This trek, this long, arduous trek of every person that they could get to go between 1863 and 1866. And when they got there, they were marching to a place called the Bosque Redondo, which was not, you know, this was not, you know, the Sandals Resort. This is when, where were they taking them? This was a very inhospitable land. It was a very uninhabitable land. And they were marching people there that lived off the land. I mean, that was how they survived. It was agriculture. And one of the first mistakes that they made when they forced them onto this Redondo was that they put them right in there with some of their sworn enemies. They get there, and there's 400 Mescalero Apaches placed there with the Navajo. And these are two tribes that have just been at each other for, you know, as long as any of them could tell. They had a long tradition of raiding one another. That continued there. A lot of wars broke out. They were left very vulnerable to other tribes who had not yet been subdued. They would come into the Redondo. They would raid them, carry off children, carry off women, carry off whatever livestock they might have. When they got there, the water was found to be brackish. They couldn't. It was almost unbearable to drink. You certainly couldn't grow crops with it. The land, there was no trees in order to there was no wood to build lumber, structures with. They had very little. They had to go miles just to get wood to build a fire. And that's where they took, what was initially supposed to be 5,000 people. They ended up taking 10,000 people to this place. The corn that they managed to grow became quickly infested with worms. It failed repeatedly. The river, the Pecos River there, that flooded time and time again. And this was going to be the end of the Navajo. And, of course, this is when a treaty was finally signed, when the U.S. government finally woke up to what was going on and that this wasn't going to work. And other Navajo leaders came to the forefront, men such as, I'm trying to remember his name right now, it'll come up here in a minute. But they came to the forefront, and they worked out a treaty, the Treaty of 1868, and that established the Navajo Indian Reservation, and they left the Bosque Redondo. And that's where that was the first Native American reservation, is the one that the Navajos worked out in that treaty. And that's really what began the reservation system. And really, the Navajo were quite fortunate in this regard, considering, you know, everything that had taken place. They were allowed to return. That reservation, you know, included the heart of their homeland. There were a lot of other tribes, the Plains Indians, the Woodland Indians, that were actually brought here. You know, and if you've been, you know, to that part of the country and then come here, that's two totally different geographies. I mean, it's totally different climates. It's just a completely different ecosystem. And they're being brought here. And it's in a strange land. They didn't adapt, and they didn't thrive, and they didn't do well. Fortunately for the Navajo, they got to stay in their homeland, and they quickly began to thrive there. So they get the first Navajo reservation system, and that quickly, over the next few decades, grows. And today, the Navajo reservation is an area that covers 17.5 million acres. It's vast. It stretches out of Arizona into Utah, Colorado, New Mexico. And it's the largest land retained by any indigenous people in the United States. And it has a population of approximately 350,000 people as of 2016. Now, what is the long walk? Really, the long walk, you know, the tragedy that was. But really, it is the summation of the U.S. policy and even the general attitude towards Native Americans leading up to that point. And, they had done a lot of terrible things to these people even leading up to this in an effort to subdue them. And we won't go over all that for sake of time, but that's when men, during that time of conflict, in the Navajo came to prominence in the Navajo tribe. Men like Barbancito and Manuelito, and these are the men that they credit with negotiating that treaty and signing it and getting them their land. Now, again, in regard to the reservations, the Navajo, they fared better than most tribes who had come to survive under this system of rule. They were again allowed to return to their homeland, and their modern boundaries of the Navajo Reservation, they were all established by 1934. So this hasn't been a long, drawn-out process for them. You know, from 1864 approximately to 1934, they acquired all the land that they have today through treaties and other things like that. So they were very fortunate in that regard, and they fared better than most. Now, where does that leave them today? Because that's really what we want to talk about today. You know, we want to talk about who they are and understand. And, you know, I find there's a lot more we could talk about the Navajo. They're fascinating. Their culture is fascinating. As you know, if you were to start to look in, maybe in your own region, if you have Native Americans around where you live, you know, you probably find out a lot of interesting things about them. But where are they today? Today, there are more than 570 federally recognized tribes in the U.S. 570 different tribes in the United States of America. And that, you know, doesn't speak to the fact that there's many that didn't even survive that time. Many, when the settlers came in, the miners came in, the armed forces came in to that land, many of them just disappeared. They ceased to exist. They were wiped off the face of the earth. But today we have 570 of them remaining that are federally recognized by the U.S. government. We have, living in our country today, 2.9 million, or 0.9% of the American population, which is Native American alone. So, again, let me say that again. 2.9 million, or 0.9% of the American population is Native American alone, meaning they're not a mixed breed, that they recognize themselves, which, you know, is up for debate, I guess. But they consider themselves to be, you know, a full Native American. Now, if you add in all of those, you know, such as myself, those that were, you know, mixed with other races, that number climbs to 5.2 million, or 1.7% of the American population. That's where you get a lot of, you know, what do they call them? The Generikees, right? You know, everyone's got the Cherokee princess grandmother, right? You know, I'm a Generikee. So, anyway. We have the states with the highest proportion of American Indians would be Alaska with 19.5%, Oklahoma with 12.9%, and New Mexico with 10.7%. There are 326 reservations in the United States. 326. You know, I read that list that we knocked earlier. There's a lot more that hasn't even been touched. That hasn't, you know, and who knows last time any Bible-believing Baptist has bothered to set foot on one of these reservations and knock a door. So an Indian reservation, basically, this is the new, you know, legally designated area that is managed by the federal government for the Native American tribe under the U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs. So they're not under state rule. They're under federal rule. Native Americans, where are they at today health-wise? You have to remember that before, they lived for so many years on a very different diet than what they're fed today. You go to these reservations, and often the only thing that's nearby is a gas station. They're eating a lot of, you know, the sugars, the carbs, these things, and this is not what their diet consisted of for so many years, where they're eating a lot of high protein, a lot of, you know, animal fat and those things. Now all of a sudden they're being switched to this other diet, and it's having a devastating effect on their health. Native Americans die at a higher rate than other Americans from diseases like tuberculosis. There are 600% more deaths from tuberculosis. Alcoholism, 510% higher death rate. Diabetes, 189% higher death rate. Vehicle crashes, 229% higher death rate. And you could tie that right in with the alcohol, I'm sure. Suicide is 62% higher among Native Americans. Indian youth have the highest rate of suicide among all ethnic groups in the U.S. It is the second leading cause of death for Native youth aged 15 to 24, is suicide. The rate of aggravated assault among American Indians and Alaskan Natives is roughly twice that of the country as a whole. 1 out of 10 Americans 12 and older will become victims of violent crime, the American Indians, that is, annually. And really, you know, it's easy to just get up and read these numbers and just hear them, and we kind of gloss over them and we kind of forget about them. We say, oh, that's too bad. But when you start to actually go knock these doors, when you actually just start to see these people and you actually see and meet the people who constitute these numbers, it'll break your heart. It'll touch you. And you'll get a burden. I guarantee it. And I'm just going to relate some of the experiences I've had going out there and meeting some of these people who make up these numbers. The first soul-winning trip was to Sacaton, where we'll be going today, on the Gila River. I've never heard the word suicide more in one neighborhood than I did that day. And I'm not talking, it was just one person and everybody was mourning. There was, my son committed suicide. I met one mother that first trip who lost a husband and two sons to suicide. And that's just a tragedy. On a soul-winning trip out here to the Fort McDowell, I met a widow who lost her husband to alcohol. She then proceeded to lose another son who slipped in the shower and broke his skull. Her last son, she begged and implored not to go ride bulls, and he did it. Ended up getting gored to death. Another widow I met on the White Mountain Apache, which, by the way, is the most receptive soul winning I've ever done, is on the White Mountain Apache. I knocked maybe three or four doors and got, you know, I saw a whole family saved. But prior to that door, I was right across the driveway at another lady's door on the white, this widow who lost both sons to violent crime. One son they found hung by a garden hose and was beaten to death. And they're tearing each other up on these reservations because they really don't have a whole lot to live for, unfortunately. And most recently on the Navajo, I met and saved a couple named William and Lapita. And this is a little bit more of an uplifting story, okay? William, it doesn't start out good. William had been carjacked. Let me just tell you the whole story. So we're out there, and I go to the store, and I knock on the door, and this guy comes out, this Indian comes out, and he's real hesitant. He takes the DVD we're giving, but he's not interested in talking, and he seems very just skittish. I said, all right, well, he's not interested. So I go next door, and the folks aren't home. Well, while I'm there, this car comes and pulls up, and I later find out it was this man's wife. This man's name was William. Her name was Lapita. And I proceed to give this lady the gospel. She gets saved. And she says, will you come next door and share that with my husband? He's really been dealing with some things this last year. And I said, sure. Is he the guy that's working on the house over there? She said, yeah. So well, I just talked to him. He didn't seem interested. She said, he'll talk. He's had some things happen. So I go over there. She goes in. She gets William to come out. And turns out William, earlier that year, had gotten carjacked in Window Rock. He was driving a car, and some people just jumped him at a stoplight, pulled him out, and beat him severely. They beat him so bad that he ended up getting airlifted to a local hospital nearby. And he told me the story a little bit later when I met up with him again. And he couldn't tell me what it was that they took out of him, but they removed some ruptured organ. And I said, what did they take out? He said, I don't know. But they took it out of him, and he was bedridden for months. And I came to find out this guy was like the hinge pin holding this family together. And he raised nieces and nephews. He was like one of the few members of his family that wasn't a drunk or drug addicted. He was the glue of that family, and he was nearly taken out by these carjackers. But since then, you know, when I met up with him that first time, when I first came to his door, I didn't know, but he was suffering from PTSD terribly. He went on and told me that he would hear, anytime he heard anything at night, he would get very afraid. He was afraid to go out at night. He was suffering very badly from it. And so I was taught, his wife brought me over there. I gave him the gospel. He got saved. And then a few weeks later, we came back, and that's when I found out more about this. I was trying to find where we'd left off, and I ended up on that same road, and I ended up in William and Lapita's driveway again. And he's flagging me down. I thought he was just waving, like, oh, hey, I remember the van, you know. And then, so I turned around, and I'm pulling out. Well, his wife hops in the car and chases me down. And says, my husband, William, really wants to talk to you. So I said, all right. So we went back, and I sat down with William. And that's kind of when he told me the whole story. But he said, you know, I was suffering so bad from the PTSD, but since you came here last time and I got saved, he said, I know I don't have anything to be afraid of. Amen. And he said he is completely healed by it. That he's not afraid anymore. He goes outside. His kids and everyone have noticed a difference. So, you know, that was just a great testimony, you know, and I'm looking forward to going back and seeing William and Lapita again. But we've had a lot of, you know, strange experiences out there. I'm sure I'm missing several. There's other people that have gone on the trips I could share. But We've come across people who were dabbling in the occult and were likely demon-possessed on the White Mountain Apache. I've had the van. I thought I saw the brother who was here with me visiting, too. If you're here, I don't know. But I've had the church van searched by the FBI in full tactical gear. That was cool. Was that you? I thought it was you. That's right. So, yeah, we were. You remember this. We were driving down. We're trying to find some structure out in the middle of some two-track. Turned out to just be like a power station or something. So I turned the church van around. We're pulling out, and all of a sudden, this Native American cop, he pulls up in his truck, and it's got lights. It's marked, and he stops me. He gets out. Hey, what are you doing? Have you seen somebody walking around that meets this description? I say, no. And while we're talking, like three or four unmarked pickups just come pulling in, dust everywhere. Guys get out, FBI, just full tactical gear, AR-15s. And they come up and they say, hey, he tells them, they say they haven't seen anybody. He's like, do you mind if we search the van? And for some reason, I thought, you know, this probably just isn't the time to stand up for my civil liberties. You know, I'm out here on federally. First of all, there's no state rights out here. It's all federal land. I just said, yeah, go ahead. So he's going through, looking under the seats, and, you know, has me come around the back and open the back. And before he opens it, he's like, what's in there? I was like, Bibles. So he opens it up. Sure enough, there's Bibles. So we've had some interesting experience out there. And what's crazy about that story, though, is they did, I guess the guy was wanted for murder, because usually when the FBI gets involved like that, it's a pretty serious crime. And I'm debating whether or not I should tell the story, because I'm trying to encourage people to come. But there was a stretch of road there on the White Mountain that same day that got shut down, and we had soul winners on that road, just a mile or two up from the road. And they were on there. That road got shut down because the FBI ended up having a shootout with somebody. I'm assuming they caught up with the guy, and they had a little, you know, back and forth, and then they opened the road back up. So that was an interesting experience. Another thing that I found out real quick on the Navajo is that they have a real problem with child abduction, which is another unfortunate thing. And really, that's something that's gone on for a very long time with their people, is that they would have, even back, before the reservation systems and things like that, the Mexicans would come up and they would take their kids and sell them to the Spaniards. They've been dealing with this for a very long time. And we were out in this one neighborhood. The first trip I ever took to the Navajo, we're driving around, and it's just nobody's coming to the door. We're like, nobody's outside. There's no kids playing. It was just kind of odd. And I just wrote it off as, well, it's just one of those neighborhoods. You know, you just got to get through it, move on to the next one. So we're driving around. We got it all wrapped up. We're driving around. We're looking for, I believe it was Brother Caleb over there. We were looking for him. And one of the locals came out, you know, this big Indian guy, and he stopped me, and he said, hey, what are you doing? I said, we're from a church. You know, we're handing out this DVD. He's looking in there. He said, well, I just want you to know that you're freaking everybody out up here. You know, everybody's calling one another. Everybody's on Facebook saying, hey, there's a van going around the neighborhood. And he says, just to let you know, there was a white van up here last week that took two of our kids. You know, and we had actually, I was in the marked church van with the wrap, but we had another white van that was in another part of the reservation that a Brother Ball, I believe, was driving. And he ended up getting stopped by the safety officer. Is that right? And he relayed the same story to you. So we've had some experiences up there, and, there's more I could talk about, but for sake of time, we'll move on up here. But, you know, that's where they're at today. You know, they're very poor people. They're a suffering people. There are people who are also very open to the gospel. And the question is, you know, how did they come to this? You know, people who thrived at one time in this country, how did they come to this? And I read a book called Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, and in the opening pages, the author, Dee Brown, states, the past has a way of intruding on the present. The past has a way of intruding on the present. Really, the reason why they are and the way they are today is because of what's taken place, you know, in recent history. And it's really easy for us to just be looking from the outside and say, well, why don't they just pick themselves up and dust themselves off and get back after it and make something of it? It's another thing to be that person that has to pick yourself up and dust yourself off and do that. And so let's have a little sympathy for them. If you would, turn over to Luke chapter 4, and we'll start to wrap this up here. In Luke chapter 4, of course, a very famous passage, verse 18. Luke chapter 4, verse 18, the Bible reads, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He hath sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised. And when I, you know, when we're talking about reaching the Native American reservations, you know, it's hard to think of another group that is more similarly described than this passage. I mean, you could say, well, he's talking about the Native Americans. And, you know, of course, he's talking about all people that fit that. But that's really who the Native Americans are today. They are the poor, brokenhearted descendants of bruised captives, people that were taken captive, abused, and now they are just brokenhearted people who have been blinded by a false way. And their poverty, you know, as sad as it is, really is what makes them receptive. Because poverty, you know, has made them a very humble people and a very open, made them very ideal candidates to be set at liberty by the gospel of Christ. So really the question is not will the Native Americans receive it? They will receive it. The question is, will we go to them? Will we make an effort to actually reach this group of people that are right in our midst? This poor, blind people that are open to the gospel. These brokenhearted people with a contrite spirit that are humble and are open to receiving the gospel. Will we go to them? And, you know, I really don't want to get into the nuts and bolts. That's going to come in the seminar, how to do this type of thing. And it's really, you know, pretty straightforward. But, you know, I would encourage people to participate in the Res Soul Winning trips here locally. And pastors and laymen, if you have the ability and the desire, please reach out to these people in your area. The vast majority of them, admittedly, are on the western side of the Mississippi. But, you know, I've seen, there's been, you know, Steadfast Church is a great example of somebody in the past who made an effort to go to the Pine Ridge. You know, maybe we can't afford to go to Africa. Maybe we can't afford to go to Australia. Maybe we can't afford to go to the uttermost reaches of the earth. But within our nation, there is an entire nation of people that are open to the gospel. And if we would just make the effort to go to them, we could win them to Christ in great numbers, I believe. It really is the poor man's mission trip, when you think about it. It's kind of the poor man's mission trip that you can take. You know, often they're only a few hours away from you, a little bit of gas, some food, a hotel room, and you could be doing some of the greatest soul winning you'll ever do. So priests, pastors, laymen, consider reaching out to the Native Americans because, you know, the Navajo, as well as other tribes in America, in the past have been very unreceptive. You know, go ask the Spanish priests about that, right? They were not open to being proselytized. They were the dominant force. They were very proud. And since then, you know, they've been humbled. They've been conquered. They've suffered. And they've been humbled, but that is what has made them open to the gospel. And, you know, it would be a real shame if they were just ignored. Let's go ahead and pray. Dear Lord, again, thank you for the opportunity to preach to these folks. Lord, I pray you'd give us a burden for all lost people, not just the Native Americans, but all of those around us that are poor and contrite, and Lord, that have an open heart to the gospel. Help us to always be faithful in preaching it to those that will listen. And Lord, I pray that you would help us to reach this people, Lord, the Native Americans, and Lord, that we would see a great work done for you. Again, thank you for all the folks that have come out. Lord, I pray you bless us as we go. In Christ's name we pray, amen.